Welcome to Trapping Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear, and we're going to continue to go with the lean system a little bit. Last week, we got into pre-baiting with making mice farms, and I was not expecting it to be more than about 10 minutes of talk, but I don't know what to say. That's just how things work sometimes. But today, we're going to continue the lean system. I'm going to start with fur shed, and then... Actually, before you get to the fur shed, what happens when you catch an animal? Just some things to think about. And Jonathan is the one that brought this up to my name. He's a student of mine. He sent me an email. And smart dude, very intelligent guy, very analytical and logical in the way he thinks. And he's laid out a bunch of stuff that we're going to cover this as much as we can today. And I'm going to be honest, it's only going to be about an hour show because I've got a sirloin tip on the smoker that I need to get off in 56 minutes. And not saying that my steak's more important to you, but it's got garlic, salt, pepper, and a whole bunch of fresh rosemary on there. And I can smell it smoking and I'm drooling already. So just keeping it real. Before we get into today's show, I want to thank our sponsors. We have... The top of the line sponsors, no question about that. I don't think anybody's going to question that. It's been in this industry for any amount of time. Look, guys, I could probably have 50 sponsors on this show if I want to. I get people all the time wanting to sponsor this show. And part of the reason I don't, the main reason is, I don't want it to be like a NASCAR, jacket, which there's nothing wrong with that, but we spend... more time talking about sponsors than you do about trapping. I didn't think that was the best way to go. The second is, you deal with people that I deal with. So if I don't know somebody, and I've been burned in the past by people that seem really good and they talk about customer service and all this type of stuff, I'm very cautious. And the money that I would get from them does not overweigh that being cautious. So I don't have a lot of sponsors. I never plan on having a lot of sponsors. But the ones that I do have are the ones that I deal with personally and with my business. And I know what to expect, so I know what you're going to get when you use these sponsors. First one is Funky Trap Tags and Supplies. They're out of Iowa. I do a lot of different type of business with Alan. I get supplies from Alan, too. But he's the ones that ships out my product. So when you order something from me and it's in the mail, you know, within 3 or 4 hours of you putting that order in, that's Alan Sayers and Alan, his helper there at Funky Trap Tags and Supplies. So I'm in constant communication with them. They have a full line of trapping supplies. They got all kind of stuff for hunting and fishing, copper trap tags, snares, other people's baits and lures. He just carries a tremendous amount of stuff for trappers, and he's punctual on shipping. He really strives to keep his prices down, which is getting hard today because trapping supplies are not out of the inflation that are. I'm not going to say anything. It's just with the people we have in charge, they're not making things easier. Next sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters, everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. So any of those, that aspect that you're into, they've got you covered. With calls, they've got aluminum dog boxes they build there in Michigan, which are really sharp. They have all the trapping supplies, the different baits and lures, DVDs. They're opening a shop up there where they're going to have a full retail trapping store. This is not what most people do, guys. You want to know where the heart of F&T is at? I'm getting ready to tell you. Most people would look at a retail store and go, I could make more money off of clothes and guns and ammo, camouflage, trinkets, different type of snacks when the kids are in there, worrying about having cute things for the house, for the women. And you go into a store that, you know, started as trapping, they get into the outdoor side, and then it's regulated down to like one shelf in the back corner with some rusty traps and some lures on there. That's not what F&T's doing. F&T's making a retail trapping store. Yeah, I mean, they're gonna have boots and some clothes because some of that stuff trappers need. Like when I get my lightweight waders, I get them from F&T. I get them, and I like them. If I was going to order muck boots, I would definitely check them out or some of my other sponsors, see what the prices are. There will be some stuff in there, but everything is going to be geared towards trapping. Now, is that going to be the most advantageous for F&T for profit? Absolutely freaking not. But their heart's with you. Their heart's on the trap line. That's how you know who you're dealing with there. Other sponsor is Oki Cable and Trap out of Oklahoma. He's got a full line of trapping supply stuff. Sometimes buys meat, buys glands, has buckets, lids, snares, sodium benzenoate. I mean, he's got pretty much everything. And he's one of those cool dudes that if he doesn't have it, he probably knows how to get it really, really quick. He'll work a deal out with somebody else to help work the deal out between you two. That's Oki Cable and Trap. And then we have Dunlap Lures. Jeff's a good friend of mine. I can see that they're trapping hard right now. Our season here, stuff's not prime here yet, not even close. But they're somewhere, are already trapping, because I see him and Sarah on there. I think they're in Iowa, but I'm not sure. They could be in Michigan. But Jeff puts a lot of pride into his product. Now, what I'm getting ready to say is going to really make some people frustrated. And you hear stuff like this all the time from one company to another. But guys, I'm here to tell you the truth. I can tell you story after story of lure makers that do the bare minimum to try to be able to keep face when they sell people products. They use the cheapest ingredients they can get with very little response from the animal because they can save money. They put their money in marketing. And the goal of a lot of these companies is to move product to new customers, and after a couple of years, those customers move on. But if there's new customers coming in, they can keep a business model working off of stuff that's subpar. But Jeff's not like that. Jeff takes a lot of pride. He learned a lot of this from his dad when his dad was a professional trapper back in the fur boom. And I've been in Jeff's shop. I've watched him make lure, and I've helped him bottle lure and actually helped him make some bait. It is not to try to see how much profit he can get out of a jar. Now, he's human. He wants to make profit. You got to make profit to be in business, or it's like Christmas gifts at that point, I guess. But he'd rather not make as much money putting good stuff in a jar as he would trying to figure out how to shortcut the trapper, because that is not in Jeff's mindset at all. So if like I said, if you never tried any of Jeff's stuff, you got to give it a shot. You can pick it up at all kind of wholesalers. Like I know F&T, I know Funky Cable and Trap has it. There's other dealers. And just call in, try it out, and you'll see what, if you've never really used good lure before, you'll see what the difference is. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the fur shed. Before I do, I'm going to tell you a story. And I saw this with my own eyes when I was trapping raccoon in Iowa. See, I load up my stuff and I head from Tennessee and I go out to trap Red O'Hearn's trap line, or his area. I don't know exactly what his trap line was, but his area. And he gave me instruction before I got started, which was mind-blowing because people think coons are so easy. When you get around someone that's a master of something, you realize there's a lot more to it than you thought and most people think. So my mind's kind of rocked with what he's showing me. It was amazing at the way that he looked at the land, which was very different from all the other competition. So I'm getting all this in my head. I've got all this stuff. I drive out there in a F-150. I don't remember the year model. It's that green one that y'all seen on a lot of DVDs and stuff like that. So I get to start running traps. And I'm catching coon. And some of the coon are in the water, some of them are on dry land, some of them have to be dispatched with snares. Now, when you get a truckload of coon mixed in with stuff in the back of the truck, what happens while you're trapping? Realistically, you get dry coon getting wet from the wet coon, and you get clean coon getting muddy from the dispatch coons, and you're getting mud on clean coons and dry coons. So just by the simple way of how you put those things in your truck, if you just throw them in there because you're worried about someone seeing you on the side of the road, which is important, that alone is going to cause you so much more time when you get back to the fur shop than you realize. See, that's part of what this concept of lean means. You have to think of every single step that you're doing. Is it because it's easier now, is it going to cost us more time in production later? And by piling up coon in the back of a truck, I know what the answer to that is. It's going to cost you more time later. Now, when I was out there trapping, and you run across the same guys all the time, and most of those guys were outproducing me. I mean, these were like, that's what they lived for, was, you know, trying to hit 100 coon a day. That's what they've done, and that's what they're going to do, and that's what they love doing. So everything about their system is based on coon, based on the fur, based on handling it, everything. So they've had many years to go, well, that don't work very good, let me try this. Well, that didn't work that good, let me try this. Good grief, these muddy coon are killing me. Let me try this. One of the simplest things I saw in the back of a truck was somebody that had built a box basically out of pallet. So he had a pallet on the bottom, and he had short little sides on the sides that probably came up about 2 feet. And he had two of these things in the back of his truck. Of course, they were cut down some, but muddy and bloody coon went into one, and they could drain to the bottom of the truck. And then he had one that he could put the dry coon in that stayed dried and fluffy. And I was like, holy cow, something as simple as that is going to mean I don't have to go back and wash off coon that were clean and dry coons that were dry and get blood off coons that didn't have blood on them just by thinking ahead. See, that's what he did, whether they realized it or not. He became more efficient. So when he gets back, all his dry coon goes straight into, I'm sure, I didn't talk to him about this, but I'm sure all this, the dry coon went straight to the skinning machine and got skint. And the other coon, they had to get the blood off of them or wash them off or hang them up to dry with the fans or whatever he's doing. He didn't have to intermix that. And when he got back, there was a system in place where dry coon go here, wet coon and bloody coon do this. Now, that is not how my experience went at all. Because most of the time when I would get back, all the coon were somewhat wet, muddy, and bloody. I saw guys out there that built trucks with these truck boxes on there like you see construction guys use, that had pallet wood in the floor so everything could drain. They had shelves on the side so they would put whatever the coon situation was at. And they had places to carry their equipment and lure and stuff in the back also. But because of their volume of coon, they used a very efficient way of thinking about how to keep stuff separated to cause them less work later. Just take a second to think about what it's like when you come back from a trap line. You know, you shot a couple of coyotes, now that blood's all over your red fox, it didn't have blood on it. Whatever it is, think about what it's really like on a trap line. How can you somewhat adjust this? Now, if you're water beaver trapping, they're all wet. I used to do things with Beaver. I'm not sure in 2022 you'd get away with it without the police being called, to be quite honest with you. The way that my truck bed was made, I could set them up above or even with the truck bed, and I would put the head of them facing the back of the truck. When I went from trap site to trap site, I was air drying my Beaver. So when I got home, they were super fluffy and dry. And the ones that I caught later, if I was with my four-wheeler, I would lay them all out where their heads towards the back of the trailer. When the top of them were dry, I could flip them over, and the bottom of them would be dry because a lot of times I'd be an hour or so away from home when I got done. So 30 minutes in, I'd flip them over. So when I got back to the fur shed, I was dealing pretty much, for the most part, dry, fluffy Beaver that I didn't have to let sit around and dry. I could get to work on them if I wanted to right then. Huge difference. I've seen pictures of old timers that used to string up muskrats when they drove cars from like where your window, your front and your side window meets. They'd run a string of these muskrats all the way around to the back of the car. So those would be dry when you got there. Out of the boat, I learned you wrap them in newspaper and you can look at them periodically through the day. And if you got three or four that the newspaper's really wet, you know the muskrat's gonna be wet. Take the wet paper off, put the dry paper on. And about 95% of my muskrats when I went to skin them at night were already dry and fluffy. Small things make a huge difference of how your operation runs that most people don't think about. Because most people, when they catch an animal, they just chunk them in the back of the truck. And you got all that stuff, whatever it is, mud, blood, water, pee, it doesn't make any difference. It's on their tools, it's on their trap bag, it's on their traps, it's on everything. And it goes, and you got to deal with all that later sometime. But at the moment, you're excited you made the catch. You took your pictures. You screamed and hollered, whatever you're going to do. Your catch dance, whatever it is. And then you just flip it over there and run to the next trap to see what's got caught. But you're going to have to deal with the consequences of that when you get back home to the fur shed. So if you're going to look at trapping through a lean system point of view, you not only do you think about everything up to catch that animal, you've got to think about everything after you catch that animal. See what I'm saying? Now when you get to your fur shed, I got better at this over the years, especially as I got older. When I was younger, dumber, way more energy, I didn't care. It seemed like I would put where I was going to stack the Beaver up in the back part of my shed, which means I had to carry him all the way across the shed. Don't know why. That's just where I decided they were supposed to go. And that's where I had the fans. And then my better lighting was towards the front of the shed. So then I would walk over across the shed, grab the animal, walk it back over to the table, do that, and then I would take the carcass outside. And then I'd have a separate place in there where, because being in the South, we don't board Beaver as much because of the issue with humidity and growing mushrooms on the leather. So we'd use a lot more hoops. So then I would have hooks all in the ceiling and have rows and rows of these put up Beaver. And I'd go around and I would put the Beaver back up there. Eventually, and this is way before I read anything about the lean system, but just for you to think about, when you take that animal out of your truck, for one, something just as simple as you back up to the door as close as you can. so you don't have to carry it the length of the truck. You're burning energy. It's like asking someone in a manufacturing plant to walk over and grab something that's heavy and awkward and bring it somewhere else where they could do the work right there where the big and awkward is at. So back up to the door. That would be my first thing. Then, where you're going to put the animals or dry the animals where you're at needs to be right where you're going to be skinning them. And when I say right where you're going to be skinning them, I'm talking like maybe a foot or two. Then on the other side of that, like another foot or two, is where your fleshing beam is at. And then right on the other side of that, now this sounds like you're in a factory, doesn't it? Then the other side of that is how your method of your boards or your hoops are going to be. See, the beaver hoops that you get, they're pretty much standard. And the beaver hooks you get for those are pretty much standard. Well, I was with Newt one time, and we happened to be, I don't know what we were in there for, but we were in a commercial fishing store on the coast of North Carolina. And we both saw these hooks that looked just like beaver hooks, except they were four times the size. And they were sharp, like sharp, sharp. And I think Newt still sells these. I don't know why they're not the standard. So if you've ever done a lot of beaver, you know, the sides of the beaver are thin and you can just pop those through there. Well, a lot of times when you get around the butt of that thing, you're struggling to get those hooks through there. And then sometimes you're like using a pair of pliers, it's hard to get leverage in this. Well, those big old hooks, they had so much leverage because of their size, you could just go funk right through the hard part of the beaver. Now, both of those are beaver hooks. One made it way much easier. One was not so easy all the time. If you're boarding beaver and you're sitting there with a hammer and nail, unless it's for traditional reasons, it just makes you feel warm and fuzzy. I've seen people use nail guns. Holy cow. It's night and day on the difference of the speed. It's night and day. There's all kind of things when you're processing an animal that I think you really need to think about. I'm using beaver for an example, just because I'm in that line of thought already. Why do you take a knife and run up the belly with a pocket knife when you can take a box cutter with the old floors that were made out of plastic that came in rolls, linoleum. I think that's right. They have hooks for those, for carpets, I think, too. Put the blades in your box cutter, start it right at the lip, go straight down, go right around the vent hole and straight out the tail, come back up, go right around the vent hole on the other side, and lo and behold, you just knocked off quite a bit of time off what most people are doing with a knife. That's simple. Why do you take a knife and go around the joints to pop off the legs or the feet when you can take pruning shears and do it as fast as whap, 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 whap? Yeah, I know. If you're in the woods and you're doing this for somebody, yeah, you're not going to have this stuff. But most of us are not putting up beaver in the middle of the woods. Everything needs to be thought about. Is there a faster way to do it? So when you lay your hands on a beaver in the back of your truck at your fur shed, how can I save energy every single time? Every single time. Your tables need to be where you're not hunched over and your arms aren't up around your armpits. It needs to be where you're naturally stand at. You'll have to figure that out. Cut the legs off. Add some length to legs with some 2x4s or something. That's what you really need to be doing. If you're somewhat handy, think about why do you put it, like if you're skinning a beaver, you put them down on the floor. Well, what if you built a table that was right at the skinning table, and all you had to do was slide down a new beaver, in, you know, whether you're using a trough or flat table or whatever you're doing to skin the beaver. What if you built that all in one thing? So when you bring them in right at the door, you've got this table you can put your beaver up on, slide one of them over just a couple of feet, go to work, have another small table to put the carcass after you get the casters out of it, have something right there that you put the casters in, and at the end of the night or the day that you're putting up beaver, then you bag them up and put them in the freezer or hang them up to dry, whatever you're going to do. But you want your feet and your body to move the absolute minimum. Part of the reason putting up fur wears people out is because they make it much harder than it should be because they burn energy with a lot of busy work that they made for themselves that's not necessary to complete the job. If you want to have a radio, it needs to be where you can change the channel or turn it on without moving. I used to watch, I mean, back in the day when VHS tapes were the only thing we had, I used to watch stuff like Braveheart and Gladiator and stuff like that out in the shop when I was, you know, doing that. And I had several movies like that. You know, that TV should have been right in front of me where the tapes are right next to it, so I don't even have to move to put a new tape in or whatever I'm going to do. Wherever your knives are at, there needs to be a place, and that's just not sitting on top of the table. Well, if you get done with a junk knife and put in a, you grab a good knife to do the actual skinning, a little distracted there, sorry. So where your knives are at, it needs to be where it's just a quick movement of your arm to get the new ones. How you're going to sharpen those or keeping them sharpened should be up on right underneath the table, hanging off with hooks if you're using steel, right above you on a shelf. If you're using when you get to how you're putting up a beaver, your nails need to be right there, your hoops need to be right there, and everything just needs to be where you try to think that, okay, I've got two really, really bad knees, and every time I take a step, it's going to hurt really bad. How am I still going to be able to do this without taking steps? See, also part of the lean system that a lot of people doesn't take into account is the comfort of the person that's doing the production. If you're sitting on concrete and you're doing a bunch of beaver or muskrats or even raccoons or coyotes or whatever, get you some of those rubber mats you can stand on that are like, you know, soft and comfy. So you're not destroying yourself when you're already tired, because you'll quit before you should because you'll start hurting, especially as you get older, especially if you're heavier. That's also part of the lean system. If you're going to be putting carcasses in trash cans or scraps or whatever, get the kind that's got wheels on them so you don't have to pick the dang thing up. You can just roll it or put it on some type of, like you see mechanics where they go up under a car, you know, the little flat thing with the wheels on them. Anything that you can do to cut energy should be one of your top priorities. Because I'm willing to bet that majority of trappers get way tireder putting up fur Not because of they're putting up fur, it's because of all the other energy they're spending. And you can sit in your shop, you can ask Cindy, I used to do stuff like this, and I would just stare at something. And I'd get up and piddle, and I'd sit back down, and I would think. And I'd get up and piddle, and I'd sit down, and I would think. And I'd move something around. That's kind of what you need to spend an afternoon doing in your fur shop. And then as soon as you get into putting up fur, if something is out of reach, if something is causing you to burn energy, you need to correct it immediately. In factories, it's a little bit different. There's normally, you're gonna write up a form explaining what would make it easier. The lean people will look it over, they'll come down, they'll see what it is. If they agree with you, they'll move stuff around. You don't have to worry about all that. If you feel like you're bending over your table, shimmy the legs up with some 2x4s or some 2x6s or something to get it to the right height. If it's too high and you need to make it lower, put a car jack under there with a 2x4 or something, get it off the ground and take a saw and cut the legs off at the distance you need and get it done. Then go back to work. You would rather spend 30 minutes fixing a problem, if you're looking at this through the lean system, than you would suffering through 4 hours of something that's going to cause you not to want to do it. I mean, I've said before, the smartest thing someone could do with fur, if you could find somewhere that's cheap, I wouldn't go buy it new unless you're really handy and figure out how to make something like this. You ever been into a factory where there's heavy stuff and they've got the rollers on the track and they can just roll whatever down, you know, the box of parts or the transmission or whatever it is? You just roll it down. There's no motors or nothing involved. Well, if you back up your truck to where there's a hole like a doggy door, or, you know, a hole that you open and you can keep it open, close it to keep the, you know, the heat in and stuff when you're done. Take the animals off, put them on the roller, let them roll into the table. You're not even having to pick the dang things up anymore. Don't roll them in where you got to pick them up and carry them. Roll them into where they need to be already. If you do have to walk because of mud or wherever your shed's at or whatever, instead of carrying things by hand, get a wheelbarrow. This does not make you lazy. This makes you smart. It makes you more productive. You want to make sure you have good enough light. You want to make sure that you can feel your hands if it's cold outside, because I've spent many a time trying to deal with beaver when I couldn't feel my fingers and the beaver was freezing back to the carcass. The skin was freezing to the carcass. Things don't work very well that way. If you need coffee or drinks or whatever, set it under your table. So all you got to do is bend down and get your Cokes out, or up on the shelf, you got your coffee pot with a jug of water that you can put the water in there. So while you're working, you don't have to go into the house and get water or whatever. Hopefully, this has got you thinking, okay, so I can really be more productive when I'm trapping. I can really be more productive after the catch, and I can be really more productive when I put up the fur. Now, everybody has seen a factory where people aren't like picking up stuff and walking around with it in their hands. You put them on carts with wheels and you push them over. You can buy them already pre-made. A lot of them are plastic. Some of them are janky. Some of them are super tough. I don't know if you'd need that or whatever. But, you know, you skin 15 beaver and you're going to put those beaver in the freezer and you've already got your bags where they're handy. You get everything ready to go. Instead of taking 5 trips with these things over to the freezer, plop them on your cart, roll them over, take them off, put them in the freezer. If you really went about your fur shed this way, looking at it through the lien system, you're going to find out that you put up more fur quicker and you're not as tired afterwards, which means you're going to have more energy to set more traps and catch more fur. That's the cool thing about the lien system. It takes thinking. Most everybody's got an uncle, a friend, somebody at work, whatever, a granddad, a dad that's retired, that if you're not a handy person with a saw and stuff like that, which I'm not, it's worth it to you once you kind of get everything close to what you know you want to build you some custom stuff to make it even easier. What could be something custom to make it easier? Let's say where you skin the beaver and you're going to have, after you take out the carcass, and let's say you take off the meat or you keep the liver or whatever you're doing, or the tail, instead of having the next table that you put the carcass at the same height, what if you just had like a short little 12-inch ramp that went down like a foot in angle, so it would just like go to the edge and go down. That would save quite a bit of energy. It's not rocket science, what I'm talking about. It's really not. It's sitting there giving yourself permission to figure out a way to make your life easier. Because if a car factory didn't think this way, as expensive as cars are now, you could add another $10,000 to them. That's the truth. Efficiency always wins. Okay, I want to go over some of this other stuff that Jonathan put in here. Looking at this through a lien system, some of these I'm not quite sure what to do with, but I think there's something that some people out there are way smarter than I am that can figure this out. Trap line planning and scouting, permissions, which farms to hit first and what order to cycle back through after you've taken the cream, and what to take on a specific piece of property to save time and prevent backtracking. Well, the first thing I would do always, and I'm still kind of old school in this, then I go to Google. Well, if I'm looking at putting out a trap line at the beginning and it's not established, I can go, well, if they even have them anymore, I'm sure you can still order them. It's called a gazetteer, and you get the whole state in there. So anytime I go trapping in Iowa or Louisiana or Mississippi or anywhere, I get one of these. For one, if I get lost, I can figure out where I'm at and how to get back to where I'm supposed to. But more importantly, I can figure out where base camp is at while I'm sitting in the comfort of somewhere. And I can look at how the roads work, the directions, how the water flows, in what directions, where the big river's at, and stuff like that. And I will mark, okay, I need to check out this because I can use this road, if I'm beaver trapping again, to hit this amount of water. And I can do some offshoots and come around and all kind of stuff. You can get very creative with this. Then I go to Google Maps or something like that where I can look with the satellite imaging. And I still haven't left the house yet. I can see where the farms are at. I can see where the way that the animals can move through an area. I can see if there's cover on the creeks and the rivers. I can see, you know, the fences. I can see the roads. I can see the access points. I can see the houses. I can see all that. And I can track, using my mouse, what I've done on paper. And I may get to parts to go, that looks really good, and this looks like this is going to be a dud. Then I'd go back to the map, because I can get a bigger picture area of that. And I can go, well, what if I went off of, you know, road 72 and cut over to 33 for 6 miles, went up and came back into this loop. There's, you know, 4 more sections of water. Yeah, that would work. So then I'd go back to Google. I'd look at it. What does it actually look like? What is the population like? You know, all this type of stuff. That's normally how I do it. And then on the map, I'm going to kind of circle what I think are going to be the best places. That could be the more water, access to water. It could be bigger farms. It could be, you know, one farm is clear cut from fence to fence. There's not hardly anything there. Then there's another farm that's got quite a bunch of timber and draws and coulees and, you know, junk laying out in the field and a bunch of roads cutting through it. I'm going to circle that one and go try to get permission on that first before I worry about a farm that's pretty much just a piece of crop with nothing else around it out in the open. Because I can kind of figure out locations better if I've got some form of structure. And then I'll go see those farmers. And I don't want to get, because we've talked about permissions a lot in the past, I'm not going to get too into this. Whatever your farmers dress like in your area, you need to dress like that. If they wear overalls, get you some overalls. If it's more conservative and you got long hair, tattoos, cover them up, put your hair in your hat. Once they get to know you, and they realize you're responsible and you're not going to do something stupid, they're not going to care if you got long hair and tattoos. It's a first impression type thing. I've tried all different kind of ways to get the conversation started with farmers. And most people go up and they'll do kind of this, something similar to this. Hello, my name is Clint. I'm a trapper, and I'm wondering if you give me permission to trap on your land. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Except from a psychology point of view, that you're another person that's coming up to a farmer asking him for something. He deals with seed salesmen and fertilizer salesmen and tractor salesmen and insurance and everything. Can I hunt your deer? Can I hunt your turkey? You know, can I go fishing at your pond? And after a while, over the years, farmer gets experiences where it's easier for them to say no, unless they have a major problem, where they don't have the headache, and it doesn't, once you leave, their life doesn't change one iota if they tell you no. Human instinct is to say no. There's no risk to the farmer to say no unless he has a major problem and already understands it. There is a risk to the farmer to let someone trap on their land. What if they catch my neighbor's dog? What if they catch my dog? What if my grandkid gets caught in the trap? What if my neighbors don't want someone trapping on it? What if my wife gets mad? What if he gets hurt? Am I held liable? A farmer can come up with 100 ways why you shouldn't be there. Is he going to rut up my roads? Is he going to leave my fences open? Is he, what's he going to be doing out there? Is he really going to be growing meth? Or, you know, producing meth? Well, whatever it is in his mind, it's going to be hard for you to overcome that. So what I learned is, and it's almost, and I hate to say this because it's not exactly in my nature, because I'm not an extrovert. I'm not a person that likes going to parties and meeting strangers. I'm not the guy in the grocery store that starts up a conversation with everybody I meet. Alan Sayers from Funky Tramp Line and Supplies, he could go to Timbuktu at 3 in the morning and have four best friends before the sun comes up. It's natural to him. I'm very quiet, believe it or not. I don't know if it's being in the military, PTSD. I don't know what it is. I do not like being around people I don't know. And when I'm uncomfortable, it makes them uncomfortable. So when I get out of the truck, I've got to hype myself up to be an extrovert for right now. So I get out of the truck, especially if I see somebody out there. Before we go through, my name is Clint Locklear, what's yours, I live over here, you know, do I know your granddad, all that type stuff. Before all that happens, with a little bit of energy, like it's very important right now, I mean, you know, you don't be a, you know, like a theater actor or something where you overdo it. But I'll just walk up to him and go, have you heard any coyotes around here? Almost like the point of, I've lost one of you, when have you heard it? Kind of like that. It's a question. But you know what his answer is not going to be? Probably no. You can't trap here. He's going to answer that, I haven't heard any, or I have heard some. My name is Clint, can I trap your property? It's really easy for him just to automatically say no. Because in that transaction, guys, you're selling yourself to get on his property. And people don't like being sold to. You don't like it. I don't like it. Nobody likes it. Because we've all been taken advantage of throughout the years from people that sell us stuff, and it is not what it's supposed to be. Have you seen any raccoons around here eating a bunch of corn? Have you seen evidence of that? Not, hi, my name's Clint. Man, the beaver been tearing stuff up. You seen any beaver on your place? Well, yeah, down on my back 40 down there, there's a pond down there that they keep putting holes in, and then they're building a dam in the creek, and it's flooding out my corn. I hate them SOBs. Would you like me to take care of those for you? I'd be glad to. See the difference of how that's structured? You need to be the thing that fixes their problem. You don't need to be the problem. You heard or seen any coyotes around here? Yeah, I hear them about every night. Sounds like there's 1,000 of them back over that way. And I think they got two of my barn cats, and something really roughed up my dog. I think it was coyotes. Well, if you don't mind, I would love the opportunity to take care of that for you. Unless there's a real reason for him not to have you there. I mean, he could be an anti, which would be weird for a farmer. He could have a crazy wife that's an anti. He may have had some type of experience in the past with a trapper that's going to get a negative. He's going to bring that baggage into your conversation. Stuff like that. If once you break that ice in a way where you're not asking or selling him something, it's much easier. Now, you may say, well, that has nothing to do with the lean system. That's psychology. And I say, nay, nay. It absolutely does. Because that's a system, how you can talk with another human being without coming across like you're asking him for something. It's just a system way to do it. I've been with Randy Smith. And he calls ahead and gets permission. And I don't know how he does that exactly on the phone. But all of a sudden, you know, a month later, they look out in the field and there's a guy going down the two track that they don't know. So they get in their truck and they fly after him because they don't want to know who it is. Randy's way of handling this made me very nervous until I saw the reaction from people. When they got close, he'd get out of the truck, and as soon as they opened the door, he'd go, "Bet you're wondering who the hell I am." Well, you know that's what they're wondering because they've never met Randy in real life. Now there's just a guy, and normally in coveralls, looks like he's been drugged through the mud. "Yeah, I'm wondering who you are." And that's pretty much what it says, what the farmer always says. "Yeah, I'm wondering who you are. I'm Randy Smith, man. I'm the one that talked to you on the phone. You gave permission to trap 2 months ago. I really appreciate this. I'm going to take care of these cows for you." Totally. The aggression that the guy was having, the anxiety that the guy was having about someone being on his land. You can watch the farmer at that point just go, "Okay. Yeah, I did give him permission. And he did actually show up. And he told me exactly who he was and what he's doing here. And he appreciates it." Now, how does most people handle that? They're going to have a case of the red ass when the farmer, if they let the farmer start the conversation, the farmer's going to be aggressive because it's a stranger on his property and he should be aggressive. And the trapper's going to act aggressive back. Or he's going to act really meek and weak. And when someone's acting aggressive, that's a huge turnoff. Because you're actually a less of a man at that time, and he definitely don't want you on his property at that point. See, the way Randy does that, I bet you wonder who the hell I am. "Well, yeah, I am. Well, I'm Randy. I talked to you on the phone. You gave permission about a month ago to come trapping. So appreciate it." Done. Before you know it, we're eating at the house. Now, you may go, "Well, I'd feel very uncomfortable doing that." I feel very uncomfortable every time I ask for permission. It's one of those things you got to suck it up if you're going to play in this game. He talks about picking a route that you get the cream of the crop. I kind of explained that. Tools for scouting, apps, methods, etc. The maps to me with the Google Earth on satellite or some form of that is really cool. There's apps out there for hunting that show property lines and actually show who owns it. Very handy for scouting. That way you're not crossing a boundary line because there's not a fence there. And now you're on someone else's property. They get upset. They call the law. You're trying to explain you didn't do it on purpose. It's just a mess. So there's plenty of stuff like that that you can do. Then he says pre-baiting. I've done a lot of pre-baiting over the years, depending on what it is. I've pre-baited for coon. I've pre-baited for fox. I've never pre-baited for cats because that doesn't seem to be as effective. And I've actually pre-baited a lot for coyotes. And most of the time, it's more generic type stuff. Dog food, miscued liver, something. You're not going to get them overly excited at the beginning. But like for a month before season, 3 weeks before season, you dig a big hole. You throw the stuff down in there. You can come and check. The reason this should be part of a system is you don't waste time on places where you're not getting action. So you may have a farm for whatever reason. The west side has got more animals than the east side. So why in the world are you going to spend a bunch of time over on the east side if that's not what the case is? So pre-baiting allows you to cut time out of your line on stuff that's not that productive. Because if you're putting in, you know, deer scraps and butcher scraps and roadkill rabbits and snakes and, you know, mixed with dog food for fillers and all kind of stuff like that, if a cow will investigate that, and there's going to be evidence of that. Now, the way that I normally would do that is I would pick a day that I would go run that line with pre-bait with me. I wouldn't worry about putting traps and all that stuff in there. I would just take my auger, dig a big hole, plop a, you know, a good amount, probably a quart of whatever this mixture is in there, and go about my business. And then the next week I'd have more pre-bait, and I would pre-bait everything again. The third week I would pre-bait again, but only at the places that saw action over the 14 days ahead of time. Now, the locations that didn't get any action, I would bypass. And I would go to the locations that have action at the pre-bait sites. So I'm not wasting time and energy putting in traps for whatever reason the animals aren't there. And I'm spending more time on the places that animals are there. See, one of the biggest lessons that I learned from Red O'Hearn when I was learning coon from him is he would bypass places that he could catch coon regularly. So we may pass six places that you could catch one or two coon. He had never slowed down the truck. He would go to places you could catch 6, 8, 10 coon at. So he was only concentrating on the places he could catch 6, 8, or 10, or 12 coon at, not the places that most trappers stop and plop into traps where they may catch one or two coon. His traps had more coon at the end of the day because he was way more efficient at where he put them. Pre-baiting can do the same thing. I love pre-baiting on beaver dams. Love it, especially for coon and fox and stuff like that, because I would mix a corn and a dog food mixture with some liver mixed in with that, or kidneys, or just, you know, cut up scraps with, you know, I used to save everything that we didn't eat off of pork chops and chicken and steaks and roast and stuff like that. I just had bags of it in the freezer. So when I go to pre-bait, I mix some of that in with this other concoction. I could take that, throw it out on beaver dams. And lo and behold, when I would come back, you would see that there, of course, the coon, if you got coon there, coon's going to be all over it. You can see cat tracks, coon tracks, otter's going to come up and investigate it. Beaver's going to come up and investigate it. Mink will come up and investigate it. Possums, everything. And when I put traps in there with more of that mixture there, or with different bait and lure, it was caught. So there's a system for pre-baiting. It's efficiency. It depends on how much you trap in a given year on how much you can pre-bait. Craig O'Gorman used to go out and dig, I think it was 400 holes over several trap lines and pre-bait them. He was catching more fox in the leggets in Montana than they were catching in Maryland, individually. He went as far as staking out, putting his trap there, getting his trap bed ready, everything. He just had the trap snapped off. Fox don't care. The ones that got hit, the ones that set, the ones that didn't, the one he didn't waste his time on. See, the cool thing about pre-baiting, and I want to slow this down here. I'm going to go ahead and stop now because it's time for me to go get that off the smoker. it allows you a way of systematically building up a trap line over many years where it's all cream and very little non-wanted as far as energy goes. A good place is a good place most of the time, year in and year out, unless something drastically happens with crops or woods or structure or something like that. If you're trapping the same areas over and over again, after year four or five, you should be able to catch in a short amount of time what you used to have to spend all season catching, because you're not wasting time on bad locations and you're proving the good locations. Or the animals are proving it to you. That's a hell of a way to put a lot of fur up really quick without wasting a lot of time. Modern day trappers, for the most part, don't do that. A lot of the older trappers spend a lot of time doing that. See, the difference today is, one, I think people, they think they're too busy to do it, and they're really not. And they don't have the same value system of catching fur as they did back then. Now, I want you to be completely honest about this, because we're talking about if pre-baiting's worth it or not. When a man could make a wage for a month, so let's say that without pulling out a calculator, let's say that you make, I don't know, $1,000 a week working, $500 a week working, $100 a day. Well, that's $2,000 for a month. Would you think that pre-baiting for a mink or a raccoon or a fox or coyote would be worth it if it was a month of your wages? You're damn straight you would. Now, they're not that kind of price right now. It's the opposite. But I know the way modern trapping is going, and it's not about the money the way it used to be. It's about the catch. Now, if you're wanting to get on social media and brag about your catch, and don't say that you don't. If you get on social media showing your animals, that's what you're doing. Would you rather have 100 coyotes in 3 months or 100 coyotes in a week or 2 weeks or a month? What would you rather talk to other trappers about? Catching 100 coyotes in 3 weeks or catching 100 coyotes in 3 months? See, pre-baiting is one of those things that's kind of a lost art that very few people do, but gets you that time for results. That's why the old timers, when the fur was so valuable to them because what they made per day was so low, they put a lot of energy into pre-baiting. Because if they were to catch 12 mink over the course of the season, that's a year's income. So what's the average year income now? 70,000? It's not the same now. I totally get that. But the value they put in on that catch was the reason that they did that. So is pre-baiting part of the lean system for trapping? I'd say for some people on some trap lines, it should be. I'll leave that up to you though. All right, guys, I will talk to y'all next week. Talk to you later. Bye.